So here we are already at the closing talk. Seems like we just started. That's what my mind's saying. It's not true, of course. It's exactly how long it should have been. The closing talk, what I like to do is really look at ways that we can build on what we've cultivated here at this retreat. Sometimes it's called integrating mindfulness into your daily life or something along those lines. I'm calling it making meditation your life. And that actually comes from my 31-year-old son, Justin, who a week or two ago, we were talking on the phone. He lives in Calgary, so we mostly talk on the phone almost every other day. I just said to him, how's your meditation practice? And he goes, well, and she goes, are you meditating? Are you meditating? He goes, Mom, my life is a meditation. And there's silence as we absorb that pearl of wisdom. And what he's pointing to for us to learn is that he's building awareness throughout his entire day. It's not just about his meditation practice, sitting on a cushion or mindfully walking or whatever it might be, a mindful movement, which are all wonderful formal practices. And I'll talk more about how those can help us in establishing mindfulness throughout our lives so that our life is a meditation. But what he's talking about is continuous mindfulness, continuous meditation, continuous awareness. There's a wonderful Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Tanjaniya, who really, really emphasizes two things that I think are very helpful for Western ears. And one of them is the importance of continuous mindfulness. And the other, of course, is chill out. I think he'd call it bring a more relaxed attitude to our practice. And I think he came to the West and saw all these meditators that are just pushing and pushing and struggling and bringing this kind of results-oriented approach to meditation that we're kind of taught from a young age to bring to everything in life. So his really first message is relax, just enjoy it. It doesn't have to be another chore or another thing to put on your to-do list that you stress about. It's meant to be life-affirming and sacred and so on. So those are the two things. Tanjaniya, and I'd like to just reinforce that for you and moving this practice forward is, to chill out around it, enjoy it, allow it to nourish you and to enrich your life. If it stops doing that, like if it becomes something else, pause a bit and talk to somebody or think about how can this be nourishing and reaffirming in my life, as opposed to something that I think I should do to be a better person, or as part of some self-improvement project, or as part of some, even some healing project. And those are things that often motivate us to come to this in the first place, but I really look at how it can then, moving forward, become something that does nourish us, which of course is healing in and of itself. And bring it into, and see how many moments of awareness you can kind of string together in your life. And, you know, can we be surprised when we're not aware? Because of course it happens, right? There's all these moments that, you know, we act, or we're just on autopilot and doing things, and of course this happens. Oh, wow, look at these kinds of, oh, I was just doing that on autopilot. I wasn't even really aware what was, my mind was off thinking about X, Y, or Z, and completely lost in thought. I'd be surprised that that actually happened. That's when you know continuous mindfulness is really starting to take hold. The other thing I'd like to touch upon is, you know, we've talked about how we relate to the difficulties in our lives, the dukkha. The dukkha, which is is like the pain and illness and so on. It's called dukkha. It's like a double dukkha, I guess. But it's just that kind of unavoidable. It's like the first arrow in that sutta that I discussed. That the first arrow is just, it happens because we're human, right? You get sick, you get a cold, you get there's a death in the family or a loved one. This is dukkha. So how do we relate to that? And then there's the sankhara dukkha, which is the suffering we then create with a story about what's happening in our lives. And I'd say that's probably 90% of the dukkha. I'm just throwing a stat out there. I have no idea. But I'm guessing it's around 90% of our suffering is mind constructed. Just quite a, you know, even if I'm half wrong, it's still a lot, right? It's a lot of unnecessary extra suffering. So we've talked a lot about how we can relate to that, and that's in terms of difficulties as well as how we relate to the pleasant in our lives, building it up, embellishing it to where it can never meet our expectations. So at the very beginning of this retreat, I let go of the expectations. We can set these expectations. Oh, I'm going to be relaxed. I'm going to leave this retreat energized, and everything's going to be fine. And then, of course, that when that doesn't happen, it's, I must have done something wrong. You know, so the sankhara dukkha starts to kick in, right? So we talked about that, and that's a core message of the essence of what the Buddha taught. He often said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And that was pretty much his message, the Four Noble Truths. And all the volumes and volumes of talks that he gave are simply a really kind of ingenious way of tailoring that message in different ways to different audiences, to different people in different contexts with different minds. So sometimes they can even seem a bit paradoxical or contradictory, because he says one thing here, but he says it's just, he's relating directly to a live person or audience. And so the message is tailored. So some of the suttas really resonate with some people, and others resonate with other people. But I'd like to add another way, and we touched upon this in terms of cultivating wholesome qualities of mind, which we ponder, what we think about and ponder is, will become the inclination of our mind. Excuse me. So the Buddha taught that to awaken to the truth of our true nature, a person must develop two qualities, wisdom and compassion. Seen as two wings of a bird, and both are qualities necessary for on this path. And some Westerners are confused by this notion of compassion. And most of us think it's a good thing to have compassion for other people. We don't think it's possible or even necessary to have compassion for ourselves. In fact, it's interesting, if you look at all the suttas, the Buddha rarely talked about self-compassion, if at all. But it's kind of, you kind of have to stretch things to find instances of it. Because it wasn't an issue. People had self-compassion. The self-hatred wasn't something that was widespread in the Buddha's day. In fact, that part of the world, even more recently, the Dalai Lama was giving a talk, and the translator used a word that indicated somebody who lacked this kind of self-compassion, even a self-hatred. And the Dalai Lama kind of went, what is that? And the translator had to talk for like many minutes to get the Dalai Lama to understand that somebody can actually not love themselves. It wasn't on his radar, and it was kind of off the Buddha's radar, I think, as well. But I think, so there's little in the suttas about self-compassion or even self-love, self-metta. But it's implied in all the practices that we do. There's a lovely quote from the Buddha. You should train yourself thus. I shall remain friendly and empathetic with a mind of loving kindness, and I shall not give in to hatred. So this is applicable to ourselves and to others. So compassion is a key part of this this path, and it's not only a means towards along the path towards awakening, but it's also what manifests within awakening. So you can define compassion as the heart which trembles in response to pain. I like that definition. The heart which trembles in response to pain. So it's kind of a feeling with. So whereas metta, if people have heard that word metta, which is translates to this loving notion of loving kindness, that's more of it is an interior attitude we cultivate. I mean, there's a loving kindness meditation where you repeat phrases of loving kindness towards yourself. May I be happy, may I be free of pain and suffering, and so forth. You repeat them to people you don't know, like a clerk at the store, you know, people that you come into contact with, but you don't really know. And then to family and friends, to people you're having difficulties with, and to everybody. And it's just these phrases that one repeats. And it actually has an interest. I've done quite a bit of it, and especially the one where I'm giving these words of loving kindness to somebody I'm having difficulties with. I had a work mate who I was really having difficulties with. It was, you know, if I sat down to meditate, it was like the top tune. It was like, you know, like a Bob Dylan hit that just wouldn't stop playing in my, you know. But I find as I did this loving kindness meditation, my heart really started to soften to the point where, you know, before I'd see her and I'd just constrict, like my shoulders would, and my body would almost go into a, you know, into fight mode, you know, the stress response and the blood leaving your stomach because it doesn't need to digest food because it's getting ready for a fight, so you get the butterflies and the whole thing, right? It's like, and it got to the point where I'd see her my heart would actually feel open. It's just this, another human being who wants to be happy. And we're just conflicting on mundane things, really, in terms of the bigger picture of humanity. That's when I really realized, wow, this is a power. Because when I first did, I thought, may I be happy? It seemed kind of, where is this going to get me? You know, repeating these loving phrases. But when I did it enough, I really started to see. You know, for me, it really struck me when I did it with a difficult person. And I think it's probably also softened my heart towards the mistakes that I make in life. A little less harsh on myself. So that's metta, or loving kindness. Compassion is action in the world, which seeks to relieve the suffering of others. So it's liberative action that we undertake in the world. And I mentioned in the talk yesterday, a book called The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And they go on quite extensively in the book talking about joy arises due to the compassion that is operationalized in the world. And what we think is, we think we get, and they distinguish that from happiness, we think we get this from the objects in the world. If I have more of this, more of that, I'll feel joyful. Where in reality, it's what we do for others. And I've heard the Dalai Lama say, kindness is a very selfish thing. Because it makes me feel great. And he giggles. But this is if you want to be happy, just pour out your generosity and compassion for others. And I think what it is it operationalizes our sense of interconnection. So your happiness is is intertwined with mine. I can't, you know, it's not like I can't construct my happiness independent of yours, because we are interconnected. The notion of us being these separate islands is an illusion. In a book called The Essence of the Heart Sutra, the Dalai Lama wrote, "According to Buddhism, compassion is an aspiration, a state of mind wanting others to be free from suffering. It is not passive, it is not empathy alone, but rather an empathetic altruism that actively strives to free others from suffering. Genuine compassion must have both wisdom and loving kindness. That is to say, one must understand the nature of the suffering from which we wish to free others. This is the wisdom. And one must experience deep intimacy and empathy with other beings. This is loving kindness." It's beautiful the way that connects all those aspects of the practice. The wisdom practices, the loving kindness practices, and then how we then bring that to the world. So this is another aspect of kind of a closing talk that I'd like to offer you, and that is look at ways that you can bring compassion into the world, ways to free others from suffering. And see what happens. I think you might find there's a lot of joy that arises. And how it manifests, it doesn't really matter. Like, don't drive yourself crazy trying to think of what. It's just an inclination. It can be simple things. You could do volunteer work somewhere, but you could help somebody that's in distress at any moment. It's the greatest gift we can offer. Just reading here, Shantideva is a wonderful writer, and wrote wonderful talks. Often taught that our enemies are what awaken our hearts. Use the word enemies. It's a translation of a Pali word, but those are, we have difficulty. So just reinforce what that story that I just told. That, you know, can you look at that person that's giving you difficulties as a little Buddha or a little Christ, somebody that's a teacher sent to you. It's actually a very liberating way to look at people that cause us difficulties. Can you actually go, thank you, universe, for sending me this person. I have something I can open my heart. You're laughing, but that's what Shantideva was saying. It's our enemies awaken our hearts. Much of the stress that we encounter or create for ourselves comes out of social situations, not life-threatening, you know, tigers trying to eat us or things like that. Of course, throughout our lives, our ancestors had to worry more about those things. In fact, our whole physiology is wired to protect us from things that are a threat to our survival, such as getting eaten, right? The whole fight or flight system. But we don't have those threats for the most part, if at all. It's threats to our social status, social encounters. But the same system gets activated and causes us a lot of stress. So think of, if you can receive some of that with this kind of open heart, how that could shift how you engage in the world. Does it make sense? Is it possible to at least explore the possibility of opening our hearts in that way? Try it. Try it and see what happens. Actually, think of a person right now that you have difficulties with. And see if it's possible to open your heart to that person. Of course, the mind wants to go to, well, they're terrible. I mean, they did this to me, and they did this to me, and they deserve what they get, and I hope they burn, and, you know. That's where the mind wants to go. But see if the heart the heart can open. Did I not just sort of read your thoughts there? Yeah, that's why there's the laughter. So those are thoughts, right? The mind's going to have a commentary. But everybody's just doing the best they can in this world. In your reality and their reality, they're not congruent. They crashed, they conflicted. My teacher, Matthew Flickstein, who's Jewish by heritage, to really drive this point home, said Adolf Hitler was just doing the best that he could, given the causes and conditions in his life, his genetics and his environment. And he was doing the best that he could. Whoa, and of course, you know, you get a reaction. That's because he's taking it to kind of, you know, the what we epitomize as a person that was evil. So when you think of opening your heart to somebody like that, it becomes maybe a little simpler to the one who, you know, blows their snow onto your driveway or something. It sounds like a lot of people have that problem. I sort of have that problem, so I probably like to like taking a shovel full and throwing it over there sometimes. Pause. Breathe. So in order to have compassion for others, we need to have compassion for ourselves. And I've heard, you know, in the small groups, the people talking about vicarious trauma and being, you know, in jobs where we're faced with the trauma of others, and how it's a constantly an outpouring of our energy in compassion, and how what we, you know, came to in the dialogue about that was how important it is to have self-compassion and self-care, so that we're there to respond So we need to have compassion for ourselves and self-love. And this whole idea of a self-improvement project, I've used that phrase here before, that's an endless task. And it's really an expression, of judgments about ourselves, as opposed to compassion towards ourselves. If I just change this, if I'm a little more of this, you can even do that with me. If I was a little more compassionate, I'd be not a bad, not pretty good. You know, if I was a little more, a little less. And it's all based on expression of judgments, likes and dislikes about aspects that our mind sees about this beautiful being. In a way, I think what this whole spiritual path is a a sequence of things we do, thinking we're going to benefit or be better people for, till we get to the point where we realize there's really nothing that needs to be done. We kind of turn away from that and just open our hearts to what is. You got genetics, right? You've got an environment, a history. Doesn't mean you don't go to therapy if you need it, or do the things to look after yourself. But it doesn't become the primary driver on the path. Where's the schedule? I always lose track of time. I love talking about this stuff. Okay, lots of time. So let's get practical. Now what? You're going to jump in your car and... because I don't think you can take a bus from here, so I think we're all jumping in cars of some kind. Going back to what we call our daily lives. to the familiar. So what do we do? What now what? Presumably you've had a taste of some stillness. You've heard some teachings around what this practice is all about. And I should add, you don't need to be a Buddhist to do any of this. I talk about the Buddha a lot. I didn't used to. I just kind of started to do that in the last few years. Well, 10 years, I guess. But you don't need to become a Buddhist. In fact, I encourage you not to become that one. Probably shouldn't say that. I should probably turn off the recorder before I say stuff like that. And I say that in the context, I mean, I encourage you to practice the teachings of the Buddha, but not to become a Buddhist, anyway, there's a distinction in for me in that. So you can practice this within any spiritual tradition or no spiritual tradition at all. So you can be a Christian, Islamic, whatever, atheist, a Marxist, whatever, and still enjoy and engage in these practices. And so I really want to make that you don't have to give up anything, and you don't adopt this as a belief system anyway, right? the Buddha in so many ways said so many times, really don't believe what I'm telling you. Go out and see if it's true for yourself. That's why I know you constantly hear me say, oh, go and try it. Like, don't believe me that help, you know, service to others will bring joy to your life. Go and try it and see if it does. If it doesn't, then don't do it. One thing that that Stephen Hick guy said that wasn't true. But I think you'll find it does bring you joy. But, you know, go and try it. So try all these teach. So they're really, and that's, I think that resonates with a lot of people in contemporary times, in our so-called postmodern times, is people like to like this notion of, yeah, it's not like dogma that I have to adopt and sort of believe, or I'm an outsider. I can engage with these practices in my life in ways that fit and resonate with me. And so I think that's perhaps why these teachings are spreading. My goodness, it's like a revolution in the West. Mindfulness this, mindfulness that, everything. Everybody wants to put mindful before what they're doing. Mindful workplaces. There's mindful government departments, for goodness sake. Done mindfulness training with leaders, athletes. Mindfulness for athletes. So it is spreading, and I think that's the reason. Well, I thought I'd put that in as important. If you're thinking now, well, do I have to adopt this as a belief system before I can proceed? The answer is no. So where do we go from here? And I'm going to give you some pointers on ways. Really, it's kind of little tips and practices to help you integrate this in your life. And I found these really helpful when I was hearing them. One of the first ones I heard, not one of the first ones, but one that really resonated fairly early on was from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, and the whole notion of a mindfulness bell. So when I think I mentioned that I spent some time living with the monks, the Thich Nhat Hanh monks. They used to have a monastery in Barrie, Vermont. Not Barrie, Massachusetts, but Barrie, Vermont. They've all moved out of there at this point. But it was a beautiful monastery that they had there. And they had this mindfulness bell. And there was actually a giant bell. Every once in a while, somebody would just go up and offer it, and everybody would just pause whatever they were doing and just check in. Where was my mind? Was I present? Kind of reset, and then proceed. Basically, just a minute, a pause for a minute. And I thought, wow, this is powerful. And so there's I think it's the Thich Nhat Hanh organization or somebody has produced a mindfulness bell that you can put on your device. And it just, you can set it so that it dings every hour or it dings randomly. I had this on my computer in my office at the university, which is fine when I'm just sitting there, you know, writing and working, but there'd be a student there and all of a sudden, bong! And you get to pick but I picked a big, you know, bong. I even got bigger speakers so that it would reverberate a little bit. And the students would go, what's that? And so then you'd have a conversation, you know. I'd say it's a chance for us to pause for a minute. So they'd do that, and then we'd have a conversation about it, which is kind of also teaching, right? Mindfulness. Some people were very interested. Others just kind of like, okay. I was going to ask you to supervise my thesis, but not so much anymore. So these are just a way of introducing mindful minutes throughout your day, whether you use the bell or something else. Something my wife likes to do is put little sticky notes, not big ones. I didn't even know they made. I think they're more for like marking pages. It's tiny little sticky notes that says "breathe" on it, and it's on the cupboard where the coffee cups are, on the remote to the TV, and it's everywhere. Right. So as soon as you're the fridge, as soon as you want to distract yourself from something, right? Those are the kind of go-to places. You're reminded to breathe. And it's actually, allowed me to kind of reset and then not need to, turn on that TV or have a coffee or whatever it might be. So it's another way of reminding us to be mindful. Because, mindfulness is not particularly difficult. Although, because we're just aware of whatever we're doing in the moment. It's the difficulty is in remembering to be mindful. Right? Just remembering. Because we get going and we forget. So any way that you can create a reminder is helpful. Whatever you can come up with, creative ways to remember, little sticky notes, a mindfulness bell. Those are two that I've found helpful and used and still use. It's not something I've abandoned. I still use those methods. And basically, the mindfulness, the reminder, you just focus on your breath, come to the body, out of the mind into the body. Come home to some stillness. So, if you remember one thing, out of the mind into the body. Tuning into your body as much as you can throughout the day. You get that wonderful thing called intuition that I talked about before. It's kind of a bonus. it's all part of the same connecting to the the inner wisdom, our inherent wisdom. And the Buddha talked endlessly about mindfulness of the body. So many suttas. The four foundations of mindfulness. The body's the first one. We start mindfulness-based stress reduction doing a body scan for weeks. It's a great practice. If you're having troubles, if when I say tune into the body and you kind of go, what's that mean? Download a body scan meditation from, I've got some online, I've got some on in the Insight Timer, one by John Kabat-Zinn. Get a one that's done skillfully. And just do a body scan for a month every day. And you'll really get a sense of a real tangible felt sense of what it means to tune into the body, the sensations in the body, the tingling, the throbbing, the touch, the temperature, or whatever it might be. And when we say tune into the breath is just the manifestation in the body. Just air, right? Leaving, coming in. So the only way you can tune into it is, how does that feel in the body? You can't follow the air. You can only follow as sensations in the body. So it too is a in some ways a body awareness practice. So out of out of the mind into the body. We tend to kind of live in the mind, disconnected from our bodies. And that has ramifications for our health and our growth on this path. And especially if you're feeling an intense emotion or you're feeling aggravated, stressed, if you can make the go-to reaction to go to the body, that would be wonderful. That would be life transforming. Or rather, it has for me and many people that I've worked with. Simple, eh? I still get goosebumps when I teach this stuff. I don't know. It's so transforming for people. And it has been for me as well, so it's... I don't take it lightly. So what else can we bring into our lives? I think mindful listening is, I think, a beautiful practice that will potentially transform how you relate, how you dialogue with others. So you know, I can remember when listening for me was watching your lips move and thinking about what I was going to say next. Right? And, that urge still arises. The mind starts to conjure up what needs to be said next, as opposed to really listening to what is being said, especially if it's a difficult conversation. It's conflict, right? You'll be going over the arguments in your head. Mindful listening is just noticing the mind's commenting about what you, but just letting that go and bringing your attention back to the complete experience of receiving the message that the other person is conveying. And that could be in their words, the tone of their voice, their face, their body language, how they're moving, the energetic, what I call the energetic tone of what they're saying, really receiving that. And we know that very little of the message in a communication is in the words. I forget the percentage, but it's 16%. Social workers out there, something like that. Yeah, might even be less. I'm not sure. The words is one of the smallest. Then you get the tone, and the face is a big communicator of message and body. I used to do this exercise with social workers where we'd plug their ears. So I'd give them a topic, a juicy topic, so to speak, something that's about compassion or something that where there's a feeling, and they'd have a dialogue where they couldn't hear the words, and then they'd tell the person what they think they were talking about, and they'd be shocked that they'd have any inclination of what they were talking about. Like, it'd be things like, I think you're talking about somebody that you're very, that you're, you love deeply, and that they're having a difficulty. you know, what are you, some kind of... And then we'd give another topic and take the earplugs out, and I'd say, just listen to what they're saying, and you can do them in either order. And they'd, so would you say, well, you said blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's pretty much what I... So it was a very kind of superficial, not the deeper... So if you can listen to all the whole message, the person really feels listened to. It's a beautiful gift to offer someone, is the gift of listening, of deep listening. It's a beautiful gift, because often we don't feel listened to. So in terms of compassion, there's a simple one to offer to the world, is just listening. Deeply, listening deeply. And we can be in our body as well. So it's a very much a bodily. So you can look at what's happening in your body as you're listening. It's kind of like you can go narrow to wide. So you can focus on your body, which is more narrow, and then wider, focusing on what's resonating in their body, in their face, and so on. And not getting caught up in the mind's chatter. So you're kind of coming, it's like kind of like coming back to the breath. And there goes the mind, come back to listening. Oh, there goes the mind, come back to deep listening. So notice when the mind's, disagreeing or agreeing with what they're saying and so on. Thinking about what we want to say next. So it's an act of love, listening as an act of love. Those are my two biggies. I got a lot more here to offer you. Transformational chores. This is a good one. I guess it's a biggie too. So if the idea is continuous mindfulness, and you look at how much of your day you spend doing chores, either maintaining a household workspace, you, teeth, your hair, blah, blah, it's constant, brush the teeth, eat something, I gotta brush them again. It's just like this. There's so much time that we spend on these chores. Rather mundane in a way, right? And what are you doing while you're doing those chores? What's the mind doing? Are you lost in thought? Or are you present with the chore? I used to use the example of, and I got this from Thich Nhat Hanh, mindfulness while you're washing dishes. And I love washing dishes and just being mindful with the whole process and the feel of the water and the temperature and the dish. And but nobody really washes dishes anymore. Well, maybe pots and stuff, but a lot of people have dishwashers now. So it may not be the best example, but that's a kind of, sweeping the floor, dusting, brushing teeth is a good one. And just kind of what worked for me was to actually pick different ones and say, I'm going to do that one mindfully. And then I'd add to it. Now I'm going to do this one mindfully. Then I'd add to it. And then it just kind of expands and expands and expands. If you do all your chores mindfully, you've got a big chunk of your day. That's where mindfulness is practiced and integrated and reinforced. Makes it much more likely that you'd be mindful once you step into the workplace or into interactions with people. So just focusing all your attention on the task at hand in the present moment as you're doing the chore. Well, one that that I still do is walking up the stairs and down the stairs. So every setting the tension to be mindfully walk up the stairs or down the stairs, to the point where if I walk halfway and I realize I didn't start the stairs mindfully, I walk back down to the bottom and start over. And the mind's kind of like, oh, I might as well just be mindful now because it's just coming back down, starting over. So and you could do that with anything. If you start it, you could kind of restart it mindfully. How that helps in your efforts to be continuously mindful. These are all just things to help you become continuously mindful. So whatever you can think of that helps you in that regard, do it. Mindful eating, eating with awareness. So before you eat, turning off all distractions, just being with the meal. Take smaller bites, eat slower, eat more slowly. You'll find you chew more and eat less. May shift. We have interesting relationships to food. For many of us, looking at the food, taking in the scent of the food, being present, slowing down, physically slowing down, will also helps us to mentally slow down. So notice how we're rushing to the next moment. So rather than being present for this moment. And the present moment is your life. So if you're missing the present moment, you're missing your life. If you're living in the next moment, which is never like you it would as you'd imagined it, you're living in imagination. So we can get more pleasure out of life when we slow down. Walk barefoot in the grass. Do one thing at a time and do it fully. The notion of multitasking has become kind of a moniker of status or something, right? Like I'm a multitasker. This comic kicking around for a while that was a manager sitting behind a desk and she called in a staff member and said, I'm having a really difficult time here, can you help me? And the staff member says, sure. And she says, I'm looking for somebody that can unitask. Because we think this is productive, right? We're multitasking. But in fact, it's not. We make more mistakes and we're actually less productive. Do one thing at a time. We're more productive. And not as drained. Our energy is not drained as quickly. Multitasking is very depleting. Energetically. And we're more prone to our mistakes. We're busier, but we're not more productive. We look busy, right? I'm running around. I've got my phone as I'm getting my coffee, as I've got paper, and I'm doing all these things. I mean, if you want to do that, well, and the boss is around. Or convince the boss that unitasking is actually the way to go. So doing one thing at a time, simply being there for what you're doing. So life's not meant to be a to-do list. It's meant to be enjoyed. Enjoyed. Watching the mind. Okay, this is a key one. watching the mind, and this came up in the small groups, kind of like self-observation, the kind of a third-party observer of what the mind is doing. So start listening to that voice in your head as often as you can. I don't mean listening as in doing what it says. I mean just noticing that it's going on, you know, and aim to just kind of be an impartial witness. You'll soon realize there's this voice, and here I am listening to it, and I'm not it. I'm not the mind. I'm not my thoughts. These are reoccurring patterns. You don't have to believe them. Reoccurring patterns based on our arising due to causes and conditions, arising due to our histories. So reactive patterns. A reactive pattern that comes up for me still is around authority. I'm not sure where it comes from. I've thought a little bit about it. I remember in high school, I was a bit of a rebel, and so I wrote papers like, you know, Louis Riel's a hero, and I wrote the history of the Black Civil Rights Movement as displayed in art, and I gave it to a guy who was, you know, a right-wing, almost fascist kind of racist guy, right? And so I get this low mark, and then I challenge it to the principal, and of course they'd always side with the teacher. So I have this real, I don't know where it comes from, but I have this reaction to authority, and it comes up, and there's a little voice that starts talking, you should do this, and you should get them this way, and you should, and so I just notice that voice. This is not me. This arises due to some history that's there. I'm not sure where it even comes from. I could ponder it, but it's not really helpful. It's just there. It just is. But noticing it allows me to be free of it. It allows some space. Doesn't mean I won't give it to the man. But it doesn't mean I necessarily will in a reactive way. I hope you get my gist. So just watching the mind, being mindful, and stepping out of that constant mental dialogue that's often reactive. Just being able to step out of that. And so I use that, you know, even though you're not really a witness, but I'll use that metaphor if it's helpful. It's kind of witnessing that mind as a something that's just chattering on. Doesn't need to be believed. You don't have to take them all that seriously. Don't take them personally. Just watch them, question them, and watch how they might be. They're just conditioned. They lose their hold over you if they're seen in that way. And then you no longer have to play them out. Very transformative. Very freeing. Everything I say stuff, you know, watching. If you remember one thing, there's so many of those. If you remember one thing, like if you do remember one thing, though, there's two now, I guess. Out of the mind into the body, and watching the mind, not believing it. So if you can remember two things from this retreat, those would be the two. Have some nothing time. Do nothing. Take Winnie the Pooh's advice. And take some time just to just do nothing and listen to the unseen, the unheard. Because you might be surprised what you find. So some do nothing time. Like actually, you know, if you live by a calendar package, your phone or whatever, Actually put in there, schedule, do nothing. So if somebody says, oh, I need you to, no, I'm busy. Something in my calendar already. Well, can you move it to another time? Nope, that's when I do this. I work out at this time, I meditate at this time, and I do nothing at this time. And really, guard, you know, keep that do nothing time as sacred time. So do nothing. So you can do whatever you want, but if you can just do nothing. Just sit in your favorite chair, in your favorite spot, gaze out the window, and throw squirrels, chipmunks, or birds. My parents are in their 90s, and I'm very fortunate to have two parents living to it in their old age. But they just find joy in the simplest things. Like, you know, I'll call them and say, oh, what's new? Oh, we saw a blue jay. I was sitting in my chair and a blue jay flew and landed in the tree and then looked at me. It was amazing. I think, wow, that's, you know, because I always think before I call, I've got to tell her this, what the kids are doing, what all these things. When you, all she has is, I saw a blue jay. It's just beautiful. I mean, she's just in her old age enjoying just those simple moments in life. And that's what do-nothing time is. It's just a time to enjoy the simple pleasures in life. That's what I do with my do-nothing time, is I gaze out the window. A kind of a gazing meditation. No phones, beepers, or whatever, just doing nothing. They'd be amazed how pleasurable and satisfying it is, and how much it gives back to your life. Mindful walking is, you know, we practice it here. I know it's a practice that resonates with some and not others. You know, if it didn't resonate with you, you know, keep giving it a try. It's, again, just bringing awareness to something that you're doing as you move. It doesn't take any extra time because you spend, you know, time walking. So I have this watch that tells me how many steps I take in a day, right? What I want—I wish you could tell me how many of those were mindful, right? So, you know, making a conscious effort to make as many of those steps mindful as you can, even before you set out to walk, setting the intention to do so mindfully as you rise out of the chair and proceed. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, walk as if you're kissing the earth with your feet. Peace in every step, as he also says. A beautiful experience at a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat. Me and 1,600 other people on retreat in basically a university college in the U.S. Campus, and took all the residences were full, and he would give his talks and we'd meditate in the football stadium. And so when they sent out the registration forms, they gave you a little map of the campus and they showed you where the football stadium was, and they said, you know, where would you like pick your first, second, third choice of residences that you'd like to stay in? And I just, and one of the options was, you know, I don't care, put me anywhere. So I clicked that one. And so I ended up in the residence the furthest away from the football stadium, of course. But as it turns out, it was Thich Nhat Hanh was two doors down, and all the monks were all in that residence, monks and nuns. And how the day would start would be we'd get up at a certain time, and he would start mindfully walking to the football stadium. And as we walked by each residence, people would join in. So it would start out with just a few from our residents, a smaller group, and then 100 would join, and then 100 more. And it's so powerful in complete silence, 1,600 people mindfully walking into a football stadium. Mm-hmm. It'd be great to start hockey games that way. the energy that instilled mindful walking into my core at a cellular level, I think, for the rest of my life. So mindful walking with a group like that is also a very joyful experience. Just doing walking mindfully. coming to our senses. Coming to our senses I say come back to the body. Get out of the mind and come to the body. You can get out of the mind and come to any of the senses. Touch, smell, sight, sound.
Taste,
that's the other one. I knew there were five of them. Just coming back to, so it's basically bringing you back to your direct experience. Because you experience the world through your senses. That's your experience. Right? If you think about it, how else can you experience your environment except through the senses? The Buddha talked a lot about this, the sense doors. Three things come together, a sense object, a sound, a sense organ, the ear, and sense consciousness. So the sound can still happen, but if you're not conscious that it happened, you didn't hear it. So you need those three things, and when those three things occur, you have contact. That's your life. How else could you receive the world except through contact of those five sense doors? There's no other way for you to experience it. So that's your life, but then what happens is you have contact, and then what arises based on your genetics and your history and causes and conditions is like, dislike, or neutral. Everything. You don't have a sense experience that you don't automatically label as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then what happens is you grasp at the pleasant, try to push away the unpleasant, and then the suffering kicks in. So this is just asking you, just come back to your senses, the sense experience. Just let the sense experience arise and be. And you notice if unpleasant, pleasant, neutral arises, but you don't have to then move to the clinging, grasping, and aversion phase of that cycle. And even if you do, you can then notice it then. So you can notice it anywhere along that continuum. I look at three circles and then a continuum, and mindfulness can come in at any time along that continuum after contact. So coming back to your senses with bare awareness, bare of judgment, decision, and identification with commentary is a very helpful practice. And the final one is urge surfing. It can be transformative for us. So next time you feel an urge, you don't have to fight it. You don't have to follow it or give into it either. You can simply observe it with awareness. This is I took a course in the mindfulness-based relapse prevention for addictions, and this was a core part of the course. People with addictions, it was urge surfing and practicing urge surfing with smaller urges, and then hopefully being able to bring that into addictive urge for a substance, alcohol, or a drug. So you're riding the ebb and flow of the urge like a wave. And the urges really kind of come in waves if you look at them closely. Comes like a wave. It lasts about 30 minutes. That's what the research shows. If you can surf it for 30 minutes, it dissipates. Which is a long time for somebody with a, you know, an addiction. But, you know, so these urges that we have, addictive urges, urges for distraction, we can bring a sense of surfing that urge. Notice if that craving has a physical manifestation in the body as well. Where is it manifesting in the body? The thoughts that go with it. And then, you know, aiming to be present with it for 30 minutes, if it lasts that long. Some go quicker. So those are some of the aspects of this practice that I encourage you to... So it's not just tricks and tips, it was... A little more than that, but ways that we can bring this practice into our life. Any questions?